Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. The economy has a lot of challenges right now. How it's experienced, of course, depends on your circumstances and your perspective. Prices have a big influence on circumstances and perspective. For groceries, housing, and transportation, the unskippable stuff, prices now sit roughly 10 to 15% above where the pre-pandemic trend would have put them, and they have basically refused to come back down. Tariffs and war have further chipped away at the affordability of daily life. And the Federal Bureau of Economic Analysis has officially confirmed that the national debt has now surpassed the size of the entire U.S. economy at 100% of gross domestic product. That's roughly twice the historical average. In this hour, we hear from two who keep a constant watch on economic conditions, and we'll hear how Fayette and surrounding counties are working together to make the area more attractive to employers and employees. First, according to data from the Kentucky Center for Statistics, a large share of Kentucky households are earning too much to be counted as poor, but still not enough to comfortably afford basic needs. If a Kentuckian is working full-time and still can't reliably afford the basics, what does that tell us about the state of the economy? Here with us to explore that question and affordability in today's economy is Michael Clark, director of the Center for Business and Economic Research and an associate professor of economics at the University of Kentucky, where he focuses his research on labor, health, and economic development. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So we're looking at surging gas prices. We've seen that on gas station billboards all over town, groceries remaining stubbornly pricey. President Trump's tariffs have lifted the costs of houses, cars, phones, televisions, sneakers, dishwashers, you name it. With these factors in mind, how would you characterize or describe the condition of the present economy?
Well, when I look at the situation we're currently in now, I kind of like to start with where we thought the economy was going to go when the year began. Each year, our center does an outlook for what we think the economy is going to look like, national economy, but really primarily focusing on the Kentucky economy. But as we were going into 2026, we were starting to see a bit of a slowdown. You know, since the pandemic, we've seen some pretty strong growth in the economy, both in terms of the output we produce and in terms of employment growth. And really, it's been extremely high relative to kind of what we see historically. And we've been kind of slowing down to a growth rate that had been a little bit more consistent with what we saw prior to the pandemic. For 2026, we really kind of saw that a lot of the headwinds were really going to catch up to us and that we really weren't going to have a whole lot of growth going into 2026, a whole lot of growth in terms of at least employment. So we were fearful that the economy was, well, we thought the economy was going to grow, but we thought the economy would grow at a really slow pace when measured by employment. And we were concerned that inflationary pressures were going to start to pick up, that a lot of the issues that we saw with the tariffs might start to actually show up in terms of prices. So that's kind of where we were at the beginning of the year. And a lot, of course, has changed in part because with the tariffs, courts ruled that those tariffs were not valid. Not quite sure exactly where tariffs are going to go in the future, but that still creates some uncertainty for, you know, the prices and how those are going to change over the next year. But also a lot of what's going on in terms of what we're seeing in the Middle East, the impact that it's having in terms of the price of oil and kind of the cooling effect that it seems to be having on the economy. If nothing else, just creating some uncertainty. The concern is really that while we were kind of just really anticipating a little bit of growth as we go through 2026, the concern is that maybe that growth doesn't materialize and that maybe we actually see a bit of a contraction in the economy. So, you know, as we look forward into terms of 2026 now, given the current circumstances, we're a little bit concerned that the risk of a recession or some type of a contraction might have increased.
I want to take a look at that again in just a moment. One thing I want to get back to is the term uncertainty, because I think most of us are feeling that right now. And I wonder how that compares to what the data shows in terms of what we're feeling as people. We've got our household budgets. We know what the numbers look like. They may be getting a lot tighter. But for those who feel they're working hard and are still falling behind, what does the data say? Is this mostly perception, or are they accurately feeling economic headwinds here?
Well, I think part of the trouble is, you know, we have a very complicated economy, and we come up with a bunch of different measures. But the measures really don't necessarily reflect individual experiences. When we look at the overall economy, you know, one of the things that we're seeing is, yes, we do have relatively high inflation relative to what we had seen prior to the pandemic and relative to what we'd like to have. Ideally, what we'd see is inflation around 2% and be relatively predictable from year to year. And we've been above that, and we're concerned that inflationary pressures are going to actually increase over the coming year as opposed to decrease. But the other thing that we'd like to compare it to is, well, how are we doing in terms of income? And in terms of income, you know, a lot of the measures that we're seeing are actually suggesting that income has increased as well. The problem is these tend to be statistics that are based on like the median household. And so we might see a lot of households whose experience really differs from that. What tends to happen is prices will tend to increase. Wages will tend to increase overall with the economy, but it may not be the same for all households. And the timing may differ. So individual experiences, certainly we can see a lot of individual households that really are feeling the pinch because they are seeing the higher prices at the grocery stores, at the gas stations, but they may not have actually experienced the wage increases that we're seeing in other parts of the economy.
Well, I think Kentucky's median household income is still pretty modest, and many counties have average weekly wages that are below the national average right now. The one widely held rub in society right now, I think, is that we see CEOs, the C-suites, being paid hundreds of times the salaries of average employees. How much of the affordability problem is really a wage problem and a problem in terms of what people are being paid?
Sure. Well, I mean, you mentioned kind of where Kentucky is relative to the national average, and Kentucky's household income does tend to be lower. We tend to have a number of challenges, and these are challenges that exist everywhere, but we're disproportionately affected by them in Kentucky. These are challenges that tend to weigh on our labor force participation in terms of our wages as well. The big one that I think about is education attainment. We tend to have lower levels of education, which is really important for the labor market because those additional skills, whether they're through formal education, you know, whether that's secondary, post-secondary, those are developing skills. Even if there are training programs that you get through employers or maybe through the community and technical college system, those are skills that affect your ability to find work and find work at a wage that allows you to pay for the things that you need through life and improve your quality of life. So the less educational attainment we have, that tends to be a drag in terms of our actual income and make affordability even more challenging here.
Housing certainly seems like a central issue here. The Kentucky Housing Corporation has described the housing shortage as the state's most urgent housing issue and says all 120 counties need more rental and for sale homes. So how does this housing shortage affect things like labor supply, business recruitment, and whether workers stay in Kentucky? How does it affect that side of the economy?
Well, I think businesses that may be looking for where to expand are looking for communities where they're employing to have a good quality of life. It's not the only factor, but you know, it's one of the many factors that they consider when they're looking for a location. So housing availability or the ability to develop that housing is likely to be really important in terms of future economic growth. We certainly do have a problem in Kentucky. It's a problem we have really across the nation in terms of housing shortages. A lot of factors have played into this. You know, part of this is the cost to actually build a house. You know, we've seen a lot of inflationary pressures there. We've seen a lot of additional pressures in terms of availability of land. Even though we have a lot of rural land, where housing is often needed tends to be in more of our urban areas. Oftentimes, we tend to have policies that may limit that, and there may be good, very good reasons for limiting housing development. Of course, Lexington has the urban growth boundary to direct development into certain areas for the preservation of the rural parts of the county. But as zoning and other types of land use policies tend to restrict supply, that contributes to the problem of housing affordability as well.
Oil is part of nearly every supply chain. It's there in some way or another. So high costs could eventually raise the price of almost everything having to do with oil, and that's pretty much everything. And of course, that causes us to pull back on our spending. Businesses aren't seeing the demand because of that, so they cut back on hiring. They may let people go. So then we see further decreases in demand as people lose incomes. Moody's chief economist, Mark Zandi, says even before the war began, their model that they use had raised the probability of the United States entering a recession in the next 12 months to an, as he put it, uncomfortably high 49%. That's essentially a coin flip. Where are you on that prognosis?
Well, we actually use Moody's national forecast when we think about what we think is going to happen in Kentucky. And I think they're right, at least in the general direction. The additional uncertainty, the price pressures that we're seeing are all things that are going to strain the economy. And so I do think, in terms of just the direction, we were in kind of a situation where we weren't likely to experience a whole lot of growth anyway. So we were somewhat at a sensitive position to some of the geopolitical risk. As we see kind of how this plays out, it is likely increasing the probability. I will say that doesn't necessarily mean that they're saying that, you know, the most likely occurrence is a recession. It's just saying there is heightened risk. This is a real possibility. But also these tend to get revised as we start seeing how the circumstances play out. So we're likely to see economists, particularly at the national level, continuously revise their assessment of the risk of a recession as these events play out.
We were just talking about the ingredients of a recession. I always wonder, how much does perception, how much does psychology contribute to a downturn?
Well, I think it can, particularly in this situation. You know, a lot of what has helped our economy over the last few years has been consumer spending. If consumers start to feel like they're in a more precarious position financially, it's very likely that they would respond by being very conservative in their spending. So they might be hesitant to spend the same amounts that they'd spent in the past. And then that contributes to businesses not earning the same type of revenues that they had in the past and start considering whether they should reduce their workforce. And then it has kind of a compounding effect, mm-hmm. right? So again, we kind of came into 2026 and kind of this, you know, not really strong growth, and that kind of left us in a bit of a precarious position. We were really sensitive to how some of these different things played out. I do think consumer sentiment is important here.
Well, in the short term, over the next 6 to 12 months, what would you say are the biggest risks to Kentucky households? What keeps you up at night?
Certainly, the situation with Iran is an issue. You've touched on a couple of the really big things in terms of the housing market. You know, we talk a lot about short-run concerns, but I think what really concerns me more is kind of these long-run issues. Kentucky has made some really good progress, but we do still lag behind the nation in a lot of important areas, particularly in terms of education. And, you know, that's a really important resource in terms of economic development, how we are going to invest in education, how that education is going to affect our wages, our incomes overall, and ultimately our quality of life. Those tend to be the things that I tend to worry about a little bit more, because I think those, a lot of the things we're talking about now are kind of these temporary things that, you know, will tend to play out. And these long-term issues are things that we've been fighting for decades and we're likely to continue to.
And many, if not most of those, are policy issues. And so when I hear that, my attention turns directly to Frankfurt. What can state government realistically do, and what's mostly beyond Frankfurt's control?
Well, I think, one, we need to recognize that when we talk about the Kentucky economy is very, very tied to the national economy. When the national economy does well, we do well. When the national economy goes into a recession, it's very likely that we're going to follow it into a recession. So a lot of what we see in terms of how the Kentucky economy plays out is really just reflecting the national trends. What policymakers in Frankfurt can do, though, is they can affect this at the margin. And there's both short-term things that they can do and long-term things that they can do. So the issue is looking at policies that make Kentucky more favorable to investment. But really, in terms of looking at the long term, is helping Kentuckians invest in education. As we increase those education levels, those are things that can potentially have really long-term economic benefits for the state.
Michael Clark is an economist at the University of Kentucky. He is director of the Center for Business and Economic Research. And we thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jose Fernandez is professor and chair of economics at the University of Louisville. And he joins us to help explain why affordability feels so tight and to get his take on the mood among economists trying to read this moment. Welcome, Dr. Fernandez.
Thank you for having me.
When people say the economy doesn't feel affordable, what do you think they're describing?
I think a lot of it is uncertainty. For the past 2 years, no one really knows where the market is going, where employment is going. We're getting a lot of mixed signals. So a lot of us are just really unsure about our futures. And when that happens, we tend to be a little bit tighter with our purchases as well.
Well, for many households, the strain on finances is coming from everything at once: rent, groceries, utilities, transportation, insurance, debt. Is it fair to say that we're living in a monthly bills economy?
For some people, I think that's very true. It's different, of course, from household to household. But let's take something as simple as going to your grocery store. Could you imagine that the price of just vegetables have increased about 40% over the last 2 years? Vegetables, right? The common things that you see all the time that used to enjoy to go purchase at a farmer's market, the price of those have increased substantially, and that hurts small households quite a bit.
What's behind that? What's driving up those prices?
Well, some of those price increases, of course, are attached to energy prices, right? Everything that must move on a vehicle requires gasoline, and we've seen what's happened to gasoline prices. Our current stretch right now is looking at a almost clean $2 increase from where we were a couple of months ago, let alone a couple of years ago. And so that's going to have a strain on the economy. But on top of that, we had a lot of other scares that came along the way. You probably remember the whole egg fiasco. Egg prices increased dramatically. That was due to issues going on with illness among chickens. So that contributes to a lot of these other problems.
And this war in Iran, which could be settled by the time that this is on the air, although when we're recording this, it doesn't seem as though that's going to happen, but it certainly is having an impact on farming and agricultural inputs, diesel fuel, fertilizer. It takes a while for that to filter through the economy, correct?
It does take a while to filter through, but it also takes a while to bring those prices back down, even when the war ends. Mm-hmm. And so although if we could, with a magic wand, end the war today and open up the strait, it would still take about 2 weeks before we see that opening of the economy reflected back into our prices. Keep in mind that we were okay with world production of oil. If anything, we were a little bit flush. A lot of the Scandinavian countries are now much more dependent on electrical automobiles. They don't require as much actual gasoline and petroleum in order to use their stuff. Same thing's going on with China. So world demand for oil is not growing at the same rate it used to be. But we went from about $68 a barrel of oil to well over $100 a barrel of oil in a matter of just weeks, and we're feeling that pinch.
President Trump's recent rejection at an April 1st Easter luncheon, I believe it was, a rejection of federal support for child care has pretty much upended significant bipartisan work to address an issue that families have emphasized is driving up costs. How important to economic health is quality child care?
Well, that's a pretty big question, because childcare alone has lots of effects. So for example, the ability to have affordable childcare could mean a difference in the household and whether or not they get to work. I remember when I was in graduate school, we were in a small little town, Charlottesville, Virginia. You actually had to predict when you were going to get pregnant in order to be able to be on the wait list, because it was more than 12 months. And that was back then. The care economy hasn't exactly grown during this period. It's getting better, but now we're near where we need it to be. And it's going to continue to feel this constraint. And let's keep in mind, like, while we're talking about childcare, the elephant in the room here really is on the other end of the population spectrum. Boomers are in that phase of retirement, and they're getting close to needing care. And there's many, many more of them than there are of us. So where is that help going to come from in order to take care of our eldest members of our society?
The Bureau of Labor Statistics is reporting only modest real earnings improvement lately. Wages may have gone up a little bit generally, but many people still just don't feel ahead of the curve. Why is that?
It's because of inflation. Although wages have increased, inflation has increased by more, which means that the real wages, what you can actually go out and buy, has effectively decreased over time. And so it is true that if you feel that you are not able to purchase as much as you used to, that's not something that's trapped up in your head. That's a real reflection of what's going on in society. Your dollars are not going as far. They're also not going as far internationally. It used to be cheaper for you to go abroad. Why? Because the American dollar used to be the reserve currency, if you will, of the world. And that demand has fallen. That demand continues to fall. It's actually much more expensive for you if you want to cross the pond and go over to Europe.
What costs do you think are doing the most damage to household confidence right now? Is it housing, food, energy, debt, insurance, all those things?
It'll, again, depend where you are in the States. I would say at the national level, it clearly is housing. Housing is quite expensive. We know that among millennials who should now be in their prime buying period, they only own about 16% of houses in the United States. A little bit better in Kentucky, around 18.8%. That's because housing is much more affordable in Kentucky than it is across the nation. But housing is the big issue. People are wondering where they're going to live. How is it that a larger portion of their take-home pay is being bought up by their home costs in comparison to years in the past? So that is a real issue. Locally, I would say it really is your other needs that are becoming a problem. Getting your groceries, getting your utilities, those are eating larger portions of your paycheck. And the big thing with those particular costs, including housing, that is that these are not one-time costs. These are reoccurring monthly costs. So people feel it every single month.
The Atlanta Fed says the housing affordability gap is near historic highs. Does housing now kind of act like a trap? People can't move, can't trade up, can't lower costs easily?
The big issue with housing is that we're not building enough for the size of the United States. We just don't have enough housing for the number of individuals that we have living in the U.S. And that is going to continue to have this pent-up demand. In addition to that issue, there's an emptying out of rural U.S. A lot of people are moving to the city centers. That's going to put upward pressure into cities, even though there's lots of downward pressure out and about. And so if people are willing to live farther away, they can find some more affordable housing. It just seems that the populations prefer to live in city centers.
So what does this situation with housing, what does that do to labor mobility and family decision-making for that matter?
I'm not a Louisville native, but if you ask any Louisville native, it feels like everyone has a boomerang story. And the boomerang story goes something like this. I grew up here. I went to my school, which is always the high school. And then I decided to go and discover myself away from Louisville. You find yourself somewhere else. You live your life. And then they say, but I want to have a family. And the boomerang brings them right back home. The boomerang brings them home because there's still affordable housing here. They still have community here. That is a part of this story that's occurring, right? Mm-hmm. It felt like everyone I asked, especially the first couple of months I was here, had this story to them.
Uh-huh. So. Yeah. Very familiar. I think we had a governor at one time, Happy Chandler, who once said he never met a Kentuckian elsewhere who wasn't on their way home.
Right.
Well, has the economy become more unequal in how it's being experienced?
That we do know is true. It's become unequal in terms of income. We see larger income inequality, even though wages are going up for just about every American. We do see a larger dispersion of income inequality, meaning the folks at the top hold a much larger percentage of the wealth than the folks at the bottom. And I think it's more visible than it has been in the past. So that's also part of the issue that's going on. Part of it is psychological. We have this keeping up with the Joneses mentality and folks are not keeping up. So we're having these issues. However, statistically, people are better off. Like if you look at the wages have gone up. If you look at living wages in Kentucky, at least the median wages, that is, if you had no children, are right above or at the living wage level. So in Kentucky, it's around $15 an hour, the calculation for living wages, and median wages in different types of industries in Kentucky are somewhere around $17, $18 an hour. And so someone who is on their own could definitely live above the median wage. You could live quite, I wouldn't say too comfortably, but you could live well in Kentucky, somewhere between $60,000 to $70,000. Of course, if you have more, it's even better. But if you're on your own, that's a good living wage. Now, if you're not there, if you're not someone who is able to get that wage, it can feel tighter. It can feel much tighter. You're going to have trouble finding housing. You're going to have trouble having continued work. So that's the two halves that we have occurring. We have a group of people who are doing phenomenally well, who are quite comfortable. And then we have another group of people who really are paycheck to paycheck. I believe the statistic is that over 40% of households can't come up with $800 in an emergency if they needed to. That's quite shocking.
It is. You talk with your fellow economists, I'm sure. And I just wondered if you had to gauge the mood among economists right now under current economic conditions in this country, how would you describe it?
Many are calling it a K economy. The K economy is where, on paper, the economy seems to be doing well, seems to be doing quite well. So if you took at averages, people are getting employed, GDP is increasing. All the indicators seem to say that things are going well. Yet when you look at the folks on the street, right, Main Street versus Wall Street, we'll say here, there is a quite large divide. We see unemployment among those individuals with even college degrees creeping up. We see people having trouble finding housing. You can consider places like in San Francisco where you have independent families having to move in with each other just to be able to afford a home. This K economy is suggesting that there is a small percentage that is benefiting greatly from it, and there is a much larger group that is very much being harmed by the current economy. So it is a two-story tale. Is that driven by AI? Is that driven by property divide? Time will tell, but those seem to be the two big things that are out there.
Do your peers mostly worry about recession or more about a long stretch of mediocre growth and stubborn affordability problems?
Right now, many of them are worried about employment. Employment is the big thing on their mind. That was the number one topic during the last American Economic Association. Really, what are the ramifications of AI as it moves forward? And what does that mean for employment of Americans? What does that mean for transitions, if they need to happen, of individuals? 2 years ago, we were like, oh, well, this is just a multiplier effect, right? It makes all of us more productive. But over the past year, we've seen large amounts of, if you will, substitution between AI and employment. And that's only going to increase with robotics becoming a larger portion of manufacturing.
What would have to happen for people to genuinely feel relief, not just hear that conditions are improving, but to actually experience relief?
Psychologically, we would like to see prices come down, but that's unlikely. What's more likely is that we have to find a way for wages to go up and for more opportunities to be made available. And so there has to be a sense of more economic clarity in the future. I would believe that people would want to know that these increases in prices are temporary and they will come to an end. They're going to come to an end rather sooner. We were living a more predictable life when inflation was around 2%. In fact, most of us didn't even talk about inflation when it was around 2%. It wasn't a thing that we were concerned about. When we could get back down to that level, people can have a better opportunity to make plans for the future. Right now, it's harder for you to make a risky decision if you don't know what's going to happen to in the future. Are you ready to move your family if you're not sure that if that economy is going to hold out okay? Are you ready to make the big investment in your house if you're worried that housing prices are going to fall all of a sudden? It really causes people to delay a lot of their decisions because they're uncertain about the future. And that in and of itself slows down the economy.
What would you suggest for that person that's really going through that right now? Maybe they're considering a job elsewhere, a big move, some sort of change coming along. What are the indicators that we want to watch in the months ahead to know whether affordability is really improving?
So some of the indicators we would want to see is, one, if interest rates start to fall, that must mean that there is more confidence that people are going to go out and buy. If interest rates increase, it really is the Fed telling us not to spend. And that's usually a bad sign. It means things are getting too heated. That's one. Two, I would say it depends on where you are in your demographic. If you're near retirement and you planned everything out well, hey, congratulations, you might go into what will be a lovely economy for you. You'll be able to afford everything while everyone else is scrambling, so take advantage while you can. If you're very young, now is the time to take the risk. You have, you know, an opportunity to make a mistake and still bounce back. And so if you're young and you're thinking about making that big move, trying out some type of entrepreneurship, now is the time to think about it. However, if you're in that middle prime working years, it's a tough decision for you. You have to decide, is it worth staying where you are? Or is it time to pivot? And that is really going to be dependent on how much influence does the international economy have on your job? Because hopefully if tariffs come back down again, you're going to face more competition if you're in that type of job. And then the other side is, how open is your position to effects of AI? And can you capitalize on it or not? So for the folks who are in that kind of 40 to 55 year old window, this is a tough spot for them. They are sitting there with their families, maybe potentially paying college bills and housing bills and everything else. And they're looking for stability. And this is a time period where it'll probably make their stomach turn. Whereas if you're just past that or right below it, I think you have lots of potential opportunities in your future.
Well, Dr. Fernandez, are you more hopeful or more worried than you were 6 months ago? And why for either?
I'm more worried right now, but I do know that this war is temporary. The reason I say I'm more worried right now is simply because this is a completely manufactured economic problem. This is not something that occurred due to the fundamentals that are out there. I'm worried that we will repeat this exercise again somewhere else, which could cost us even more. I'm more worried that the federal government doesn't seem to be as fiscally responsive as we would like them to be, which means in the future, there will likely be higher taxes and lower services. As a public employee, that's already a big issue on my mind because I worried about the state cutting more resources to higher education and other things of that level. So those are the real worries that exist. However, I do realize that these are temporary. We can't have a war forever. We can't have these sustained cost increases forever. At some point, someone is going to stop paying the bill and we'll have to pull back.
It's Dr. Jose Fernandez, professor and chair of economics at the University of Louisville. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard. The ability of a city or a region to compete on a national level can determine its quality of life and the nature of its future. Commerce Lexington and regional business and local government leaders have been working to develop a regional competitiveness plan, a 5-year strategy that began in 2023 to support job creation and workforce growth across the 9-county region that includes and surrounds Lexington and Fayette County. And they just released a progress report on this, and here to walk us through some of the details are Commerce Lexington President and CEO Bob Quick. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Tom.
And the Chamber's Chief Policy Officer and Director of Regional Engagement, Andy Johnson. Thanks for joining us, Andy.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Bob and Andy, before we get into the numbers here, what problem was this regional competitiveness plan designed to address?
We're competing against big mega regions all across the country. And we can either have a life of disappointment that we're not competitive enough, or we can do something about it. And we did something about it. And I got to tell you, everything aligned. It was beautiful. We had public-private sector leaders working hand in hand. And Thomas worked.
First, just so that we can kind of orient here, this is a 9-county effort. Besides Fayette, which are the other counties?
And the contiguous counties to Fayette, plus Montgomery.
How about that study, Andy?
So, Tom, one thing that we saw coming out of the pandemic timeframe was that the economic landscape was rapidly changing. And government leaders, business leaders recognized the need to work together to build on the collaboration that Bob spoke about that had been 40 years in the making, but to have more intentionality behind a strategy to compete against those much larger metros that we were seeing jobs and talent moving to. I would say that one of the most shocking things when we started this process a few years ago was that economic landscape, that snapshot that showed the region was losing economic momentum. We were behind the national average in several key categories. And so the point of the plan was to find things that could be low-hanging fruit, mutually beneficial action items for all communities in the 9-county region that would help all of us increase jobs and workforce. And so that's really what brought us to the report. The regional leaders said, we don't want to work on 20 different things. We want to work on a handful of action items that we know are going to immediately make an impact and reverse those trends. And so what you see is really a midpoint check-in with this report. Is this collaboration working? The things that we're doing together, are we seeing jobs increase? Are we seeing workforce increase? Are we making more things through GDP in the region? And the answer is yes, we are. The economic momentum has shifted. We are seeing really five specific things. The economic progress is improving. Jobs are increasing. Labor force is increasing. The wages people are making in the region are increasing. So those are all positive indicators. We've seen strong job growth across all communities in the region. We've seen labor force growth across all 9 counties. And that is because, you know, we're attracting good jobs here. We also have a strong quality of place. Low cost of living, quality of life is high, and that's a competitive advantage. The fifth thing that I'll mention is just that we have addressed a challenge that we saw a few years ago, the lack of job-ready land across the region. It's not just a Lexington issue. It was a challenge in all of the communities. And our local government partners have really stepped up and are working on creating more sites for jobs throughout the region. And that's really been an advantage when it comes to recruitment and attraction.
9 jurisdictions with differing priorities, political dynamics. How challenging is it to keep everybody on the same page and moving forward in unison?
First thing I would say was we, over the past 40 years, have been building trust. A fundamental aspect of this was trust. And you earn trust when you're very transparent. And when the first meeting has everybody at the table, not just a few select individuals. And then the other thing, we hired Ted Abernathy. Ted is a genius at regionalism and economic development planning and so on and so forth. And we just brought everything together on the front end. Everybody was in the same room, public and private. And what we did is we started that dialogue to talk about where our shortfalls were and what we needed to do if we wanted to be competitive. And we also talked about our strengths. And interesting enough, what our regional group of 45-plus individuals shared, both the challenges and the opportunities, proved to be right on to what the studies that we had done told us about ourselves. So I think at the very beginning, we all had a buy-in, but we all were at the table for the first meeting. And again, a lot of communities, they miss some of the fundamentals, and we could have, but we've been down this road a lot over the years, and it was very clear to us that we needed to be at the table all together.
I would say, too, Tom, that businesses and people, they don't recognize county lines. And business leaders and our local government leaders have recognized that, and that we are stronger when we market ourselves as a regional unit. The 9-county region is over 700,000 in population. Quality of place amenities, our education amenities, our job sites, our housing opportunities. I mean, we are more competitive when we tell our story together. And that is how people are looking at us. And I think we, for the first time, had a recognition among leadership that that was important to do. And everyone saw the value in that, because telling our story together gets more awareness to the region as a whole. And that ultimately trickles down to each of the communities. They each have unique assets that deserve to be shared. And together, the package is stronger.
Well, a lot of points here to dig into in the time that we have. And one of them is something you mentioned, Andy. There's a new multi-county business park effort. Tell us about that. Where would it be located?
So there are two sites in Madison County that regional leaders from, there's a three-county partnership. So Scott County Fiscal Court, the City of Lexington, the City of Berea, and the Madison County Fiscal Court. For the first time ever, you've got a regional collaboration where these local governments have come together to form a regional partnership and are working to develop sites as a unit. So the initial sites are in Madison County, but they have got a revenue sharing agreement so that once jobs are located there, they're going to share those revenue costs, and it's ultimately going to benefit the communities in each of those places.
The data suggests that the region added about 20,000 workers in just the past few years, and that was after a pretty long period of slow growth. What made the difference?
Well, we had an organized plan, and we had all bought into it. And we followed that plan to a T. We had great leadership with Ted Abernathy, as I mentioned a minute ago. And we just started doing the things that, instead of talking about them or agreeing and disagreeing and putting things off, we jumped right in.
Tell me more about that, because that was a huge obstacle.
It was a huge obstacle. Again, I think more than anything else, there was a lack of trust going into it. And these are all really good people, trust me. This is not a shot at anybody, but it just, how the process flowed and worked was not right. There wasn't a lot of buy-in. You had some counties that were going to be receiver counties of funds, and people were like, you got to be kidding me. You know, just very upset about it. And it finally did blow, but by that time, enough people had come together to try to stabilize and rebuild relationships. But again, I go back to what changed is we had a plan. It was very well defined. It was easy to follow. You know, we had our hiccups. But everybody knew we were all marching in the same direction.
You've more or less placed bets on advanced manufacturing, professional services, logistics. Why those particular sectors?
Those are areas where we have clusters of opportunity here. We've got an existing workforce to build on. So we did an economic analysis a few years ago in combination with the regional competitiveness plan, and it indicated that advanced manufacturing, medical manufacturing, pharmaceutical manufacturing, aerospace, business and professional services, as well as logistics and food and beverage, which would be because of the bourbon industry, were all areas that we needed to lean into. These were targeted sectors that we had potential for growth. And the exciting thing about this mid-year check-in is that we are seeing job growth within those sectors that we're specifically marketing to. Manufacturing added over 1,700 jobs over the last 5 years. Medical manufacturing and pharmaceutical is up over 50%. Aerospace, 16%. Business and professional services, we're a hub here in Lexington. That's over 25%. So the areas that we're focusing marketing resources and developing relationships with site selectors and business targets, we're seeing improvement. And it's just something that it's great to see that it's working. We just got to keep leaning into it and keep doing those things that we're doing.
Do AI and automation present headwinds to that momentum?
I would say they provide an opportunity for all of us to figure out how best to make those work in our regions, because it's not a passing thing. It's going to be a backbone. We're finding in meetings that I'm going to now, national meetings, that people are getting a grip on that and understanding that. I think initially there was just a lot of uncertainty about what it all meant. And there's going to be a lot of changes. The one thing we know well is life is full of changes, economic development especially so. And you got to keep up with the changes. But we're at a position right now where we can create from AI what we need to make business more efficient, our communities more efficient. It's going to come one way or the other. I'm always one of those, let's jump out there and take it by the hand and figure out how it can best work for us.
How important to attracting new business is quality of life, quality of place, such things as the quality of local schools or culture?
It's top of the list. Talent attraction today, what people are looking for, is quality of place. And it's just as important now to being able to find a job. We recently had Development Counselors International. That is a firm that does workforce economic development and place-based marketing. They helped us develop the Greater Lex talent attraction campaign. We saw some recent data from them that at the top of the list with quality of place is housing availability, housing affordability, cost of living. That's what people are looking for. That's what they're comparing things to. So fortunately, that's something that our region has a significant advantage on. When we did this report or the initial plan 3 years ago, we were just behind Nashville on quality of place. It was something that just jumped off the charts that we needed to tell our story at a greater level to let more people know that this is a wonderful place to live and work. Those of us that are here know that, but folks that maybe haven't been back in a while just need to be reminded of what a special place this is.
Couple things I want to run by you in that particular space, and one has to do with what we're all reading in the papers right now about Fayette County Public Schools. The system is in crisis. There's no question about it. We're seeing reports of a multi-million dollar shortfall, audits, concerns about longstanding accounting practices and oversight, staff cuts, a reduction in hours for those who remain. So when companies are thinking about relocating and when workers decide about whether they want to move their families there, how much does instability in a public school system factor into those decisions? And what does this moment mean for the region's ability to compete for talent and business right now?
First of all, I would say education, K through 12 and beyond, is very critical. It's a critical element of our success and our ability to recruit. There's going to be some audits coming out, shedding more information. And when that does, all I can tell you is that we'll be there trying to do everything that we can to help every way possible.
On the cultural side, there was a recent analysis performed for LexArts and presented to the Urban County Council that found that the arts and cultural ecosystem in Lexington supports about 4% of the city's overall local employment, generates about $1 billion. There was unanimous feedback from stakeholders mentioned in that report that one of the city's greatest strengths is the people who form this creative ecosystem. And that includes performing and visual artists, producers, nonprofits, authors. Yet I don't see the arts included among what are considered important local economic drivers or metrics. Why is that?
That's a very good point about having that addressed in our, it, to me, comes under quality of place. Mm-hmm. As one of many different areas. But that's something that we're always trying to draw attention to because it does add a whole point of creativity and the ability for us to showcase ourselves. And I know in existing business visits and other interactions, that's an important question that we get raised as far as to us is what's our arts community, what's our entertainment community look like? And it's easy to go show them.
It is, but the city's investment in the arts, in arts infrastructure, in support of artists and art making is lackluster at best. And it seems to me that the investment sends the message that you're trying to send, that we have this quality of place and quality of life. Look at what we're putting into it. Do you think that the city should step up a little bit more on behalf of the arts?
Well, I think all of us always are hoping that the city will step up and invest more money in us to do more things. You know, that's kind of an interaction between LexArts, the deliverer of many of the arts programs, and the city. But I will tell you, it's an important thing for us to sell, and we do, and it's well received, and we've got a lot to offer here. And it's just something we got to continue to grow and make sure that it happens.
On another issue that we're all talking about these days, and that's housing. Housing prices have risen dramatically faster than wages in many cases. When you hear from employers, how often does housing come up as a barrier to hiring and relocation? And it's not just Lexington, it's nationwide.
Housing is a key challenge across the board. We hear it in conversations with employers about workforce attraction and retention, the need to have more supply, more affordability, particularly in that what we call the workforce housing zone, and that is 80% of area median income all the way up to 120% of area median income. Those are areas where there aren't necessarily federal subsidies available. And so it's a niche area where we're seeing less and less inventory in that bucket, particularly here in Fayette County. So it's one of the things about the mid-year check-in with this KPI report that was listed as something to keep our eye on, because our affordability is something that has a trend line of increasing in a way that's not what we want to see, that is going to impact our quality of place and our cost of living indicators. When housing has increased over the last decade 100%, whereas the wages people are making here in the region have only increased 30%, you can see how that imbalance will impact things. So it's something that we continue to work on with our local government leaders and at the state level, trying to figure out what we can do to increase supply and keep affordability in a range that makes us competitive.
Any particular policy changes, local or state, that you would like to see local or state officials look at?
For Commerce Lexington, something that we have been talking about with the mayor and the city council is just the need to have a development liaison that works with and across city departments to try to, once a housing development plan has been filed, that it helps get that through the process faster. A challenge has been the number of development days that projects are in that process. And so trying to cut that down and get supply online faster when it's approved is something that we're working on. And then trying to figure out creative public-private partnerships for uses of land for affordable housing and infill are also top priorities.
There's that old saying, the same thing that makes you rich makes you poor, the risk that success can change the very thing that makes a place attractive. How do you guard against that?
Having a plan, really thinking about strategic balance, because we want to protect the assets that make us unique, our horse farms, our agriculture land. It makes the Central Kentucky region special. So we want to make sure that we're preserving those resources and those assets, but also strategically thinking about growth, where that needs to go, the types of businesses we want here, just making sure that we have room for everyone that wants to be here in the community and in the region. And just planning appropriately for that infrastructure is what this effort is all about, just strategic, balanced growth.
Why does this plan matter to somebody who might not ever read a report like this?
Number one, it shows that when we come together, what we can do to build a better economy, to provide better jobs, to be able to deal with all the uncertainties and challenges, but we all come together to figure out how to overcome those and create new successes. It also shows a lot of our younger people, really people of all ages, but especially our working population, that we have opportunity here. That they can have a good living, that they can have a good job and be challenged and spend a lifetime here.
From Commerce Lexington President and CEO Bob Quick and the Chamber's Chief Policy Officer and Director of Regional Engagement, Andy Johnson, thank you both. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're on the WEKU, Apple, Spotify, and NPR apps. You can stream all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while you're there, you can check out our contributors and their interview archives. And send your thoughts and suggestions to us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard.